You got government data, and you got government data. Point is, you gotta read the fine print. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday, today, the very first day of July. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin today with tomorrow's big economic headline, the unemployment report for June. It's going to be ugly or not too bad. Unemployment's going to go up or maybe down. We'll have added jobs in June or we will have lost a bunch. Fact is, we just don't know. And we don't know because what's happening in this economy is so far outside the norm. Pretty much since the beginning of this pandemic, and they have been really upfront about this, you got to say, the Bureau of Labor Statistics has been counting people, well, the wrong way. Marketplace's Andy Euler has more on what's been happening, what the BLS is doing to fix it, and with how many grains of salt one should take tomorrow's report.
The Labor Department calculates the number of jobs added or lost and the unemployment rate by calling up a representative group of Americans and asking them about their employment status. The Bureau of Labor Statistics is now providing more training and new instructions to the people asking the questions.
What we have is a coding problem.
That's Joe Bruzuelas, chief economist at RSM. He says the problem isn't software coding.
We have individuals interviewing people who say, well, I'm a stadium worker, but there's no work. They were classified as employed when they should have been classified as unemployed.
Turns out it's a really confusing situation, both for the questioners and those answering them. And once a response is part of the record, it stays that way, even if the BLS knows that data may be questionable. Jay Shambaugh at the Brookings Institution.
They don't want to sit there and say, oh, we're worried these people should have been counted as unemployed, so let's relabel them. Because then I think they quite rightly could be accused of kind of messing with the data.
Shambaugh gives the BLS credit for recognizing the problem, alerting everyone to potential errors, and annotating the report. But Michael Pierce at Capital Economics says, bottom line, this is a vexing problem.
If you get called up and you asked, are you employed? It's a good question. If you're a restaurant manager and your restaurant should be reopening, but you're not sure when, it really is an open question. You know, am I employed or not?
He also doesn't think simple training is going to make answering a question like that much easier. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Not to pile on here, but there is one more grain of salt to add to your reading of tomorrow's unemployment report. All the data for it was collected during the week of the 8th of June, which is to say, before all the virus spikes and the ensuing state reopening pauses and walkbacks. Speaking of which, governors in the tri-state area of New York, Connecticut, and New Jersey have been through the worst of this pandemic so far, anyway, and they have come out the other side, and they are taking no chances. They have imposed a two-week quarantine on visitors from 16 states where cases are surging. Violators could face fines of as much as $10,000. Not entirely clear is how those restrictions are going to be enforced. But as Marketplace's Kristen Schwab reports, businesses could be on the hook.
Travelers are looking for rest and relaxation when they arrive at the Cod Cove Inn on the coast of Maine. Now they also get paperwork called a Certificate of Compliance. Ted Huger is co-owner.
It's a great big long form, and basically it's making them testify that they'll behave when they're here and wear their face masks and all that kind of stuff.
Maine has some of the country's strictest travel rules. Anyone not from Vermont or New Hampshire must show they've tested negative for COVID-19 or quarantine for 2 weeks. And it's on employees of hotels, Airbnbs, and campgrounds to enforce the rules.
To have them act as the police for the state is just really unreasonable and unfair. This layer of enforcement paints us as the bad guy.
Visitors flying into New York are given questionnaires and may be contacted by local government. As for people coming by train, bus, and car, Amanda Castell, an epidemiologist at George Washington University, says that would take contact tracers, law enforcement, even toll booth operators.
That's a lot of resources to make this work.
She thinks compliance comes down to social responsibility. Think back to stay-at-home orders.
People did it because they understood the importance of staying home to prevent the spread of the virus.
But as we've seen with masks, not everyone will follow the rules. Florida has had travel restrictions in place for a while. Jeff Lubkamin at the Florida Restaurant and Lodging Association says it's been working with businesses on how to de-escalate situations.
Not singling out a guest using phrases like you must, you should, you shall, but rather as a matter of public health, we ask that.
Add policing and public health to the growing list of things hotel and restaurant workers probably didn't think they'd signed up for. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Wall Street on this day before an early jobs day. Usually it's Friday, right? You knew that, but it's a holiday this year. Anyway, stocks kind of mixed. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Companies, as you know, have started taking a hard look at diversity in the past month or so. The diversity of their employees and their leadership and, in a way, their customers. Goldman Sachs said today it is not going to help companies go public anymore, won't help handle their initial stock public offerings, unless that company's board has at least one diverse member. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has that story.
When calling for more diversity on corporate boards, Goldman Sachs is talking about people from chronically underrepresented groups, whether due to gender identity, sexual orientation, race, or ethnicity. When Goldman CEO David Solomon announced the change in January, he acknowledged to CNBC that his bank was pretty much going it alone.
We might miss some business, but in the long run, this, I think, is the best advice for companies that want to drive premium returns for their shareholders over time.
Some companies have been trying to improve, says Stephanie Creery at the Wharton School of Business.
Most of the gains that they've made are focused on gender diversity. And so all other firms' diversity, including racial diversity and ethnic diversity, are lagging significantly behind the push to increase gender diversity on boards.
Even with that progress, according to research from Deloitte, women hold less than 18% of corporate board seats in the U.S.
And those who manage assets like Goldman Sachs, they know that there's only so much of a case you can make to motivate people and boards to increase diversity before you have to mandate it.
And changing boards takes time, says Peter Gleason. He's CEO of the National Association of Corporate Directors and works with companies to diversify their boards.
But the fact of the matter is corporate boards don't turn over very frequently. So you've got a great supply of people and little demand, so to speak.
So starting today, Goldman will require at least one woman or diverse board member for an IPO, and next year, at least two. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Clothing sales have been among the truly abysmal performers in this coronavirus economy, down back in April as much as 90%. But for every economic reaction, there is often an equal and sometimes opposite reaction. Resale clothing, in the present case. Sales of secondhand merchandise from the likes of Poshmark and Depop are growing, as is the online used clothing platform ThredUp. It does mass market brands as well as designer goods for women and children. And it has just announced a partnership with Walmart.com. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra visited ThredUp Distribution Center in Phoenix to get a peek behind the scenes.
I visited ThredUp way back on March 4th, before the lockdowns. We'd just gotten to the point where people had stopped shaking hands. So when I met the company's president, Anthony Marino, in a conference room, we elbow bumped. Then we headed down a hallway into a 120,000 square foot warehouse. Just inside, we saw these piles of plastic bags, white with green polka dots.
And inside of those bags is clothing that families across America send to ThredUp.
ThredUp is an online thrift store. If you want to clean out your closet, the company will send you a postage-paid mailer that fits a hamper's worth of clothes. You fill it up, send it back, and ThredUp resells your clothes, sharing anywhere between 5 and 80% of the selling price. It all starts at the merchandising stations, where workers tear open the bags.
This is Merch Station 25. Hi, Betty. Hi. That's Betty. It's Isaiah. They're just making sure that the items look good. They're assigning that item to that hanger.
And each hanger has a barcode, so the item can be tracked anywhere in the warehouse. Betty Ross, who does inspections, pulls out a beige dress by the Spanish brand Desigual and holds it under a bright light.
I can already see that I'm going to reject it because I have yellow, a yellow stain right here.
It's near the zipper. If Betty accepts an item, it still has to get through her teammate, Isaiah Bosk, who's standing at a computer maybe 8 feet away. He grabs a black and white plaid blouse and shows me the underarm.
Look at this. Do you notice the color difference right here? It looks like it's got a yellowish tint to it. That's from armpit sweat.
I honestly don't see it. And Anthony Marino, who's giving me the tour, says there might be a customer who orders that blouse and doesn't notice the stain.
But there might be another one who does and then never shops again.
ThredUp is strict about what it accepts because it's fighting a long-standing stigma that used clothing is unsanitary. The rejects get recycled or sold in bulk to thrift stores. The chosen items get carted over to the next station, where they're placed on mannequins, positioned in front of a wall, and photographed for the website.
A typical retailer takes an item and takes one picture of it and sells 10,000 of them. We have to take a picture of every single item that we sell. They're all unique, precious little snowflakes.
After the photos, the clothes are put back on their hangers and shuttled on a conveyor overhead into a series of racks, 3 stories high and several football fields wide. They hold millions of garments. In between, there are these metal walkways, accessible by stairs. That's where Marino takes me next.
So, you're in the belly of the beast. We're surrounded by clothes. They've been photographed, quality checked multiple times, and now they're just waiting to find a new home.
Soon, it'll be time to fulfill some orders. This happens in waves, several times a day.
So what's going to happen in a second? See how all the lights are lighting up on top of each carousel? Each carousel is rotating to bring a piece of clothing that someone has purchased to the end.
Workers stand on the walkway with devices strapped to their forearms that tell them exactly where to go and what they're looking for. The racks start spinning. Ruby Tienda looks down at her device and sees an image of a pair of denim shorts from Banana Republic, size 8.
It tells me the carousel number, which is 99, and then level 2. So it'd be this one.
Boom.
And then you scan it.
Scan it.
Put it on here.
Off it goes.
She hangs the shorts from a conveyor that'll carry them to the other side of the warehouse, where they'll get packaged and shipped. Since I visited ThredUp, the whole world has changed. The company's decided to keep its distribution centers open through the pandemic. It offered furloughs with benefits to employees who weren't comfortable working, but it's ended those now. Some major retailers have boosted pay. At ThredUp, wages have stayed the same. At the distribution centers, like the one in Phoenix, employees' temperatures are taken before every shift. They wear masks. There are markers on the floor so everyone stays 6 feet apart. Everything's moving a little slower. Except, since the pandemic took hold, people are sending ThredUp more bags of clothing, 60% more. I caught up with Anthony Marino recently.
There are a lot of people who are home. They're looking for space in their house. They are seeing more than ever that they have clothing that they don't need or don't wear, and they're sending it to us.
And from mid-March to the end of May, as retail sales plummeted, ThredUp sales jumped by 20%. Maybe because a lot of brick-and-mortar thrift stores are closed, or because people are looking for a bargain. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
Coming up,
I think you have to ask yourself, who are the winners and who are the losers?
I think you do indeed. The pandemic across the pond. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials down 77 points today, about 0.3%, closed at 25,734. The NASDAQ up 95 points, about 0.9% there, 10,154. S&P 500 up 15, about 0.5%, 31.15 for the close. Pfizer shot up 0.3% on some promising virus vaccine news. On the other hand, Inovio Pharmaceuticals down more than 26%. The medical news site Stat reported that firm had not given sufficient data to show that its vaccine actually works. Companies profiting from the virus lockdown also saw benefits. Amazon up 4.3% today. Netflix up 6.7%. Bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note, 0.67%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Brizdahl. We've been doing some coverage about economics as a profession lately and how, honestly, it's got a race problem. It's got a race problem in how it's taught and in how people get into the field. Black people specifically and black women for us today in particular. As just one data point, in 2018, less than 0.5% of all the economics PhDs that were awarded to black women. An organization called the Sadie Collective is working on doing something about that, getting more black women into fields like economics and data science and finance. Anagifti Opoku-Ajiman is the CEO and one of the founders of the Sadie Collective. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. Such a pleasure to be here.
Tell me, first of all, would you, a little bit about Dr. Sadie Alexander.
Woo! I am so happy you asked about her. She's amazing. So Dr. Sadie Alexander is America's first black economist. She received her PhD in economics in 1921 from the University of Pennsylvania. And she also received her JD from the University of Pennsylvania in 1927 when economics decided that they didn't want to let her become an economist. And that's how her legacy sort of lives on through sort of the work that she did as a lawyer alongside her husband.
There is, of course, a distressingly small number of black economists at the upper levels and actually also in the pipeline, too. So I guess what I need you to do right now is make the connection for me between improving that pipeline and getting more black women into the field and the end result of economic policy. What happens when you reach your goal?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I literally just published an article, and it's with the Economic Policy Institute about Black Women Best, which is an economic policy idea mm-hmm. coined by Janelle Jones, who is one of the managing directors at the Groundwork Collective. And pretty much this idea says if we center the economy around black women, everybody is alleviated in terms of outcomes. And so in order to do that, you actually have to have black women in the room, right? And one thing that mm-hmm. we've recently seen is there's no black women in Federal Reserve leadership. And so it's really important that those individuals who are making important decisions at a high level are representative of the world that they're hoping to make decisions for.
And we should say Janet Yellen, former chair of the Fed and now the president of the American Economic Association, is in word anyway on your side. She's come out about the importance of diversity in her field, your field.
Yes. Yeah, so Dr. Janet Yellen, who I affectionately call Janet, we're on a first name basis.
That's funny.
Now,
I call her
cool.
Dr. Yellen, you know.
Yeah. is a huge supporter of the Sadie Collective, which I think is incredible. She was actually our one of our keynote speakers, at our conference this past year at the Urban Institute. And with regards to diversity and inclusion, I think Dr. Janet Yellen's sort of someone who personifies that a bit, right? She's the first female chair of the Federal Reserve. And so it's incredible that she's now coming out and supporting black economists, especially those in the pipeline, in this way.
All right, so let's get to nuts and bolts here, right? Because as I'm sure you'll recognize and admit, you have a heavy lift here, right? There is a lot of work to be done to get where you want to go. You recently published an open letter to economics and I suppose everybody with a list of things you want to see happen. You and your group want to see happen.
Yeah.
What are the top like couple of three things that will be most tangible to get black women in economics and related fields in positions where they can influence policy?
So I want to go ahead and kind of correct that a little bit, right? You said we have a heavy lift. It's all of us. All of us have a heavy lift, right?
Yep.
So I think that this idea of putting it on one organization to fix the pipeline problem or even a couple organizations, you know, that's not the way we should be looking at things. With regards to the open letter, I'm so happy that you mentioned it. So there's a couple things that we definitely want to see happen. First and foremost, folks need to be citing more black economists. And then I think the next ask is specifically for the Federal Reserve System. So the Federal Reserve System recently has been sort of in the news for structural racism at the leadership level. I would argue it's at every single level within the Fed. And so one thing that we've asked in our letter is that Federal Reserve banks across the system must commit to recruiting from at least 5 HBCUs a year, including the Sadie Collective as well, which is now home to a lot of black women in economics. And so this is really to ensure that this idea of I can't find black talent is squashed, right? A lot of people say that when HBCU might be in their backyard. And I think the last ask that I will say that's really important is also thinking critically about honoring Dr. Sadie T.M. Alexander and the birth of black economists within this profession. But in order to do that, there needs to be some institutional support. And so we have actually called out the American Economic Association specifically to take on this effort.
When we get to where we need to be
and
fulfilling the goals of the Sadie Collective, what does that look like for black women economists? Describe that world for me.
What that looks like is if a black woman economist is contributing to work, it's not a shock. And so it's important for us to think critically about how do we loop in institutions to set the change, set the standard, so that we're able to see Black folks in this specific field normalized and celebrated in a way that allows the next generation to follow closely behind.
Yeah. Anna, thanks a lot. That's Anna Gifty Opoku-Ajiman. She is a co-founder, also the CEO of the Sadie Collective. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Come Saturday, which is the 4th of July, as it happens, people in Britain are going to get some freedom from their quarantine rules. But celebrations are going to be tempered by anxieties over their economic future. Rising unemployment, of course, but also a longer-term worry about what this pandemic might have done to British entrepreneurialism. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard has that one.
For a real entrepreneur like Bree Reed, inspiration can strike in unusual and unexpected ways.
I was walking down a very posh shopping street in Edinburgh called George Street, and I started to feel my tights slipping down. Eventually, I felt them slip below my knees.
A humiliating wardrobe malfunction that convinced Bree that ill-fitting tights were a widespread problem. So she launched Snag Tights, a company making the garments to fit women of all shapes and sizes. And 2.5 years later...
We now turn over about £2 million a month. We have 47 employees and we send 10,000 pairs of tights out every single day to over 90 different countries.
The COVID-19 crisis, though, threatened to be the undoing of Snag Tights. Sales slumped by 75% and the company didn't qualify for government assistance.
Very rapidly we realised that the help wasn't going to come and we were going to run out of money by July.
But always fast on her feet, she appealed online to her customers' loyalty and offered two pairs of tights for the price of one, with delivery delayed until November. Inundated with orders, she now has more than enough cash to carry on.
It was incredible. You know, overnight we went from a huge risk to being a kind of safe and a stable business.
The rebound did not surprise the woman behind this annual awards ceremony.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. And a massively
Fran James, founder of the Great British Entrepreneur Award, says there are countless examples of small businesses adapting, changing tack, moving online and pivoting during the pandemic.
I've been bowled over by the resilience that I've seen, by the creativity that I've seen, by the tenacity and sheer determination from the entrepreneurs that we work with.
But she admits she's in the celebration business. There are others who take a more jaundiced view of the impact the pandemic is having on the British spirit of enterprise.
I think you have to ask yourself, who are the winners and who are the losers from this coronavirus?
Andrew Hilton, head of the CSFI think tank.
The people who are the winners are the people who work for the public sector. They have jobs. They have complete security of tenure. They have pensions.
He believes that many small businesses weighed down by the debts incurred during lockdown will go bust. Or if they survive, he says they'll face a far more hostile economic climate in the future. The massive intervention by the state, pumping hundreds of billions into supporting businesses and jobs, means that big government, much heavier regulation, and perhaps higher taxes are on the way.
That really is then going to dull the edge of enterprise and entrepreneurialism.
The great loser in this whole affair is the entrepreneur, the small entrepreneur.
Defying the pessimism in her warehouse in Edinburgh, Bree Reed is still shipping 10,000 pairs of tights a day, in spite of her earlier brush with insolvency. But does she have any doubts about the future?
Does that not worry you that this country could be heading into a more bureaucratic, a less entrepreneur-friendly kind of culture?
I think that's definitely always a worry. We need to make sure the government understands that the freedom to trade and the freedom to do business is a huge part of actually just employing people and keeping our way of life the way that it is.
She says millions of jobs are riding on that message. Small companies like hers now employ two-thirds of the British workforce. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which things really are upside down, I guess. Tesla, the electric car maker, which has been a publicly traded company for just about a decade now, has become the most valuable car maker in the world. That is, of course, by market capitalization, share price times the number of shares outstanding. And yes, fine, it is kind of a visionary company, but it's also worth more than not just Toyota, but also the old standbys like Disney and Merck and ExxonMobil. That's a lot. Okay, we are out of here, but first, this moment of economic context. The Federal Reserve released the minutes of its most recent meeting today. Here is the money quote. Participants commented that there remained an extraordinary amount of uncertainty and considerable risks to the economic outlook. You got that, right? You know what that means? Also, and just like the jobs report that's coming tomorrow, that Fed meeting was before things got worse. Our media production team includes Robin Edgar, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Jay Siebold, Charlton Thorpe, Ben Tolliday, and Becca Weinman. They, once again, are the ones going into the studio so the rest of us can stay safe here in a room attached to your garage. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.